The construction industry in Indiana has depended on Quality Supply and Tool, a local family-owned business, to deliver quality sales and service over the last 25 years. The employees make the difference, like sales expert Nick Worley.
What sets us apart is we only offer quality tools and supplies from quality manufacturers. We have a quality trained sales and service staff knowledgeable of the products we sell and offer. Quality. It's in our name.
On South Harding Street in Indy, plus Bloomington and Jeffersonville, Quality Supply and Tool thinks outside the box. Store.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it.
Beyond the Bricks with jQuery and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5. The Fan.
Hey, good evening to you on this, the 15th of May. My name is jQuery. Mike Thompson here as well. Landon Kuhn's working behind the scenes in the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center in this episode of Beyond the Bricks. And each and every year, I think, in this, the fifth year that we have done this program, when it has fallen on May the 15th during the course of the week, for whatever reason, and I don't know exactly why it is, but on the 15th of May, I immediately think to the date because it was on this day, sadly, obviously, and tragically, that two incidents happened at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway that I wanted to simply mention off the top. Because I think a lot of people, when they hear that date, remember these two events. The first would be it was on this day in 1982 when Gordon Smiley was involved in, certainly from a single car standpoint, what probably is the most gruesome and horrific crash to be caught on film at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And Gordon Smiley, who, of course, from Nebraska, lived in Grapevine, Texas at the time, was fatally injured and lost his life at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in pursuit of trying to get his car up towards the front row or lay down the kind of speeds that would get him the sponsorship and the long-term stability at Indianapolis. And certainly Gordon Smiley thought of on this day. In addition to that, it was 10 years after that on this date in 1992 when Jovi Marcello, who had not qualified before for the Indianapolis 500, went out for a practice session, was involved in the south end of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in a crash that also would fatally injure Jovi Marcello. And several years later, as I've mentioned before, I was at IMS during a non-race event-related day and just happened to completely serendipitously meet the widow of Jovi Marcello, Irene Marcello, who was accompanied by her son, Jovi Marcello Jr., or the second, depending on which way you want to look at it. And she was actually pregnant with Jovi Marcello's son at the time of his crash. She was in the air on the way back to the Philippines when the crash happened and learned about it upon her landing, and now lives in Vancouver in Canada in the Vancouver area. But she could not have been nicer, an absolute Jim, so too was Jovi's son. I got to meet both of them, and they were at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway simply because it was the first time that they had been back. She had been there in 1992 at the early stages of practice, but she wanted to come back and see where it was that, of course, everything happened, and has become a friend and lovely people. And so certainly we think of both Gordon Smiley and Jovi Marcello tonight. But this day also has symbolism. It has, from a positive standpoint, it has memory as well, not only for Donald Davidson, the Speedway Historian Emeritus, or the Historian Emeritus of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, but Mike, also for you, because I know one thing that is in common for both of you is on different years, this is the day also that you remember as the first time that you entered the gates of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
That's correct. For both Donald and myself, May 15th is the first day that we are on the grounds at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Donald was, of course, in his first year in 64, and mine was in 1982 on the sad day that we lost Gordon Smiley. So, yeah, it's exciting for me to think about the first day I was ever there, because there was so much anticipation. I had waited almost a year to get to finally go. And I've told the story several times about how my Uncle Ron said I couldn't go till I was 12. And I turned 12 in March of 1982. And so I was ready to go in May of 1982. And we drove all night overnight from Toledo. And I was very, very excited to be there for the first time.
And in May 15th of 1964 is when Donald Davidson first visited the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And here is Donald Davidson talking about his first trip to the grounds that would, of course, be those in which he would become synonymous over the years.
Oh, way beyond, because I'd seen the films and read the books and, you know, the Floyd Clymer books and everything. So just everything, it was surreal to be here. But the thing, and I can't stress this enough, I was absolutely astonished at how friendly the people were. And this, it sounds like, you know, the Chamber of Commerce talking here, but I was astonished. I never expected the drivers to be, and the car owners to be such open, and the chief mechanics. And a few of them were a little reserved, but I thought they would all be. And to immediately be taken into the inner circle and first name basis and within, you know, minutes of arriving, within an hour or so of arriving, I was being invited into garages. And the day after I got there was the first qualifying day. And it just seemed like I met everybody.
Now, Mike, you know, for yourself coming to the Speedway on this date in 1982, for Donald coming to the Speedway in 1964, you know, everybody has kind of their favorite memories or their favorite drivers, their favorite races, their favorite cars, their favorite, all of those things. And when we're looking at, especially on this show that we're going to kind of do about Donald and his journey at the Speedway, one of the things that leads us to do is to kind of bounce around to different topics when it comes to Donald, including one of the things we're going to talk about and hear from Donald next, right, Mike?
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things I wanted to do tonight is hopefully, for the most part, most of the interviews you'll hear with Donald tonight, hopefully are things you've never heard before. We kind of went back in our archive of Donald interviews that we've done over the years. And so hopefully these are some topics that you haven't heard before. So I hope that'll be fun for folks. And one of the things I did want to talk to him about, though, is I think folks know that Donald really likes the 1960 duel between Jim Rathman and Roger Ward. And I asked him about the winning car, the Ken Paul Special, because at one point there was a little bit of confusion, I think, from folks that people thought maybe Ken Paul was a product, you know, a car wax or whatever it was. But I actually asked him about the fact that Ken Paul, they're people. It's not a product. The winning car is a little bit different in the fact that, you know, we think of all these cars with their fancy sponsor names. Yeah. The winning car is the Ken Paul Special, and those are just two random guys, right?
It was. A lot of people thought Ken Paul was a product. It was Kenny Rich and Paul Lacy, and they just made that name up and hyphenated it. And I think... and then Jim Rathman and Chickie Hiroshima, who was the chief mechanic, they went to Watson's shop to pick the car up and then towed it back, the two of them. Just the driver and the chief mechanic towed it back. And then, you know, they took it back to Dallas, I think, which was where Kenny Rich or Paul Lacy, or maybe both of them, were from. And then prepped the car. And I think so by race day, I don't know, they probably had, you know, maybe $35,000, $40,000 in the whole operation, and you could win considerably more. I think it was like $110,000, I think, was first prize by then.
You know, Mike, over the years, I know you've had the chance to talk to Donald about, you know, all kinds of different drivers from different eras, and it's interesting because when we think about some of the speed thresholds in qualifying, you know, R.A. Leyendijk, the fastest four-lap average in qualifying history. Tom Sneva, the first at 200. Parnelli Jones, the first at 150. You had the opportunity to talk to Donald Davidson about Jimmy Snyder, who's kind of a forgotten-about driver, but was the first to break the 130-mile-an-hour barrier in qualifying. Donald Davidson on Jimmy Snyder.
Yeah, Jimmy Snyder, of course, as the years go by, he gets pushed further and further into the background. But for many, many years, he would be considered as one of the great drivers who did not win. And he had five starts, 1935 through 1939, and he led the last three. In 1937, he was from Chicago, from the South Side, and they called him the Flying Milkman because he'd actually been a milkman. And Emil Andres, who I knew quite well, actually told me that Jimmy Snyder came to his door one day and said, you know, I want to be a race driver, and you are. How do I get into this? Anyway, so 1935 through 39, as I say. In 1937, he got the ride of a lifetime because the specifications were changed. And they had been for 366 cubic inches from 1930 through 37, with a view to encouraging the American automobile companies to come in. I mean, that was huge. In 1926 through 29, it had been 91.5 cubic inches, 1.5 liters with superchargers, but they were Millers with a few Duesenbergs, with virtually nothing to do with the automobile industry. And so the specifications under Captain Eddie Rickenbacker's leadership were to encourage, at least, American production engines. And it didn't work. There was the Wall Street crash. That's not the reason the specs came in. They were already announced. That's a myth that we can't seem to dispel. And so supercharging had not been permitted except on two-cycle engines. And in 1936, when that was lifted, apparently it was done very quietly, and there was a Bugatti at the track. I don't know what the cubic inch displacement would have been, but not nearly that big. With a supercharger, it didn't make the race. Well, Art Sparks, with financial backing from the infamous Joel Thorne, they built a six-cylinder engine. I don't know what it would have cost. I mean, it was very expensive to do at the time. I don't know what that would be in modern dollars. But anyway, the end result was a killer race car with a 366 cubic inch engine. And you could supercharge, but there was no... Up to that time, any time that superchargers were allowed, there was no two different specs for supercharged or unsupercharged. You either put a supercharger on it or you didn't. The cubes were the same. And they put a supercharger on a 366 cubic inch engine, which I think is like, is that 6 liters or something like that, I think. Massive. And so in practice, with a rider mechanic, Chickie Hiroshima, on board, Jimmy Snyder recorded the first 130-mile-an-hour lap.
Now, the reality is, you know, Jimmy Snyder was from Chicago, Mike, but that he wasn't alone in that regard. There were, as Donald talked with you about, I know, a number of drivers from Chicago, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Chicago, there was a group actually known as the Chicago Gang, but this didn't have anything to do with Elliot Ness or Al Capone or the Untouchables or, you know, Kevin Costner or Sean Connery or anything like that. Donald talked to me a little bit about kind of the rich history of Chicago drivers at the Speedway.
Billy Arnold came out of was from Chicago. A little later on, Pat Flaherty. This is, you know, years later, 1956. Pat Flaherty was a Chicago resident for many years, but he wasn't from there. He was actually a West Coaster who came back right after the war to drive hot rods for the Granatellis at Soldier Field and Rockford, Illinois, and so forth. And He married a lady, took up residence in Chicago. But I think probably what you're referring to was that Emil Andres was a short shirt-tailed cousin of Tony Bettenhausen. I'd never seen exactly what the lineage is, and all Emil would say was, yeah, he's a shirt-tailed cousin. But they were related. Duke Nalon was from Chicago. And then, you know, Paul Russo was not from there, but lived there for a while and was considered part of what they called the Chicago gang. And, well, there was another guy who was quite the comedian, drove midgets with fair success, and was at the Speedway, took a test, was a riding mechanic in practice named Cletus Cowboy O'Rourke. He was part of the Chicago gang. And there were a number that were participants that did not drive in the 500. Teddy Duncan was one. Great midget driver from that area, and took a test at the Speedway, but never was able to have a start.
Some of the great clips from Donald Davidson on this episode of Beyond the Bricks. And when you're talking about Donald, obviously you're talking about entertainment, so you would never be bored. That would be B-O-R-E-D. But bored is a term that was key to racing, especially in the early years. More on that when we return to Beyond the Bricks.
In the construction business and can't find what you need, Quality Supply and Tool has served Hoosiers for over a quarter of a century. Tom Hawk is the branch manager of the Indy location on South Harding Street.
We've always been big on keeping our shelves fully stocked of inventory of industrial-grade tools, concrete, masonry products, as well as the necessary accessories to help get the job done. You don't have it, you can't sell it. Our experience allows us to help with getting the pros as well as the weekend pro taken care of.
Quality Supply and Tool also has locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to help you think outside the box. Store.
Hey all, I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there, but you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at kesimpta.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
KitchenAid saves energy, money, time, and energy, so save your energy with KitchenAid.
This is Donald Davidson for the new KitchenAid Energy Saver 4 dishwasher. I want to invite you to come over to Wheels Furniture and Appliances at 5320 West Washington. I'll be there after qualifications from 7 o'clock until 8 o'clock on Saturday night, May 10th. Come in and I'll try and answer any questions you have about the 500. And the people at Wheels will be there to answer any questions you have about the KitchenAid Energy Saver 4 dishwashers. They'll tell you how you can turn down your hot water heater and save 10% or more on your total cost of heating water. And now's the time to buy because they're offering special trade-in allowances. Come over and see us Saturday evening, May 10th, to Wheels Furniture and Appliances, 5320 West Washington. I'll be there from 7 to 8.
Be sure to visit Wheels in Indianapolis. That's Wheels Furniture and Appliances at 5320 West Washington Street.
Now, I need to let you know, this is on tape. This is an old advertisement. He is not, Donald will not, Donald's still around. Donald's doing well. We talk to Donald all the time. He's not going to be at Wheels Furniture. He was not there 5 days ago. You did not miss out. He was not there 5 days ago. On this, the 15th of May, good evening to you in 2025. It is Beyond the Bricks. Jake Query along with Mike Thompson. Landon Coons is inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, where he is just now reloading his KitchenAid dishwasher that he bought from Donald Davidson many, many years ago. With that always fun ad, we're taking a look back at Donald Davidson's brilliant career and all of his contributions on the radio throughout the course of the last several decades. Talk of Gasoline Alley, also working with the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network. If you were ever listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley, perhaps while you were on an evening drive, you might have been out near Turkey Run State Park. If you were in Turkey Run State Park, you might have seen the remnants of Jungle Park, one of the many racetracks that took place back in the early years in racing. And what you may not realize is that a lot of those racetracks were board track eras, meaning literally the racetrack was not made of dirt, not made of brick, but rather made of wood. Mike got a chance to talk to Donald on one of the earlier programs and ask about that legendary era.
And in one case, one race. there were the total number of board tracks would include the ones that where they would run championship cars, and typically those were a mile and a quarter, or a mile and an eighth. And then there were just a handful that were half miles. Woodbridge, New Jersey had one that was a half mile, so they wouldn't run championship cars on that. But they had fabulous speeds, made out of wooden planks that were placed on their sides, and so you'd run on the edge of the boards. So the speeds were phenomenal. Frank Lockhart in 1927, Atlantic City, I believe, he did a lap at 147 miles an hour. I mean, for the times, that was just extraordinary. But the downside to the board tracks was that the upkeep. And depending on where they were, I mean, there were several on the East Coast and upper. They were in odd places, and there was never one in Indiana. But there were several on the West Coast, and probably Altoona, Pennsylvania, is probably the best known one, arguably. Although Beverly Hills would be another one, but Beverly Hills lasted from 1920 to 24, when the land became so valuable that they pulled it down and made a development out of it, and then Altoona went from 1923 to 1931, and I think that survived the longest, I believe. But anyway, land becoming valuable in the case of Beverly Hills, and then just the general upkeep, the weather, they were constantly replacing the boards, and sounds like made-up stories, but I mean, I had a number of board track drivers were still around when I first showed up as a young man, and they would tell me, you know, kids would climb underneath the banking and then put their heads up through where the wood had rotted and hadn't been replaced yet. And so you'd actually see a couple of heads in front of you that would duck down, or you would try to straddle them. So, but anyway, in the case of a fabulous track was built at Fulford by the Sea under Carl Fisher's ownership, and Ray Haroon, 1911 500 winner, was the general manager. And it lasted one race. They had a 300-mile race. Peter DiPaolo won it. And very shortly thereafter, there was a hurricane, and it blew down. One event. And it was a fabulous place. And so apparently, rather than rebuild, they used the wood to help rebuild Miami Beach, which was devastated.
Mike, interestingly enough, when you think about, and of course, I guess you think about the fact a board track with wood would be flammable. That's probably a bad segue. But the reality is that fire was not a stranger at any point in the world of racing, but certainly even to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, notably, Mike, back just before the Speedway would go dormant through the war era.
Yeah, there was a famous fire in 1941, and it's strange to think about now, but the fact that there was a fire, a huge fire, at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in the garage area before the start of the 1941 race, and that not only did it have an outcome, impact on the outcome of the race, basically, because the water from the fire hoses, you know, washed away a mark that Wilbur Shaw had made on one of the wheels he had, and he basically didn't want that wheel put on, and that's the wheel that failed and caused him to crash, and he missed out on his chance to win, you know, three in a row. But it also knocked a car literally out of the race because the car burned to the ground before the race even started. So it's just amazing to think about that happening, you know, before the start of the Indianapolis 500. And I had the opportunity to talk to Donald about that and what a strange occurrence that was.
The race, actually, the dart was delayed by a couple of hours because of a fire in the garage area at something like apparently 7 o'clock in the morning. One of the two rear-engined four-wheel drive supercharged Millers, very early rear-engine car, was being fueled with gasoline in the garage, and supposedly the fumes from the gasoline slipped through a crack in the wooden slats that made up the walls in the garages and went through Pepe Le Pew style into one of the other garages where one of the Joel Thorne cars was having some last minute welding work done. And when the fumes met the flame, then there was an explosion, and it ended up the garage area in those days. There were two banks by this time running east to west, and it was the eastern third of the southern bank which ended up being destroyed, and all of the race cars and equipment had to be pushed out. All of the cars were saved except the rear engine Miller, which was qualified by George Barringer, just about burned to the ground. There was also a dirt track car that was not part of the 500 entry list, was damaged considerably, but that was the only car that was lost in the fire that was in the race. But a lot of tools and spares were lost, and there were a number of heroes, you know, rolling the cars out and getting the fuel supplies out and all of the spares as the garages were burning quite furiously. So the race got delayed by a couple of hours.
6 years after the fire, not related to the fire, obviously, but 6 years after the fire, there were only 30 cars in the field of the Indianapolis 500-mile race. Donald Davidson explains why.
An association was formed called the American Society for Professional Auto Racing, ASPAR. And it began, I think it was largely a driver's group. There were a few owners involved. And originally the idea was to have some representation with regards to the different facilities that the participants would go to during a year's time. Well, then prize money became an issue. And there were those that felt that the standard procedure for a 100-mile dirt track race was that there would be a guaranteed purse or 40% of the gate, whichever was larger, so that there could conceivably be an overage. Well, Indianapolis Motor Speedway had never paid an overage, and their thinking was that perhaps the Speedway should. And that there should be, because of the fact that qualifying, there was no prize money for qualifying at the time. And so anyway, it shifted directions from being a California-based operation to moving to Chicago and some more probably more volatile characters becoming involved. And many of the people that started it, like Rex Mays and some of the other drivers that were well known to be mild-mannered, began to sort of almost have to distance themselves because of the claims that were now being made and the threats that were being made. The entries were rather slow to come in. And ASPAR claimed to have all of the top cars, which they did not. The Ted Horn Maserati that had been driven by Wilbur Shaw with Cotton Henning as chief mechanic, that was an entry. Lou Welsh now had a second Novi. He was not a member of ASPAR, so two Novi entries came in. And then also Lou Moore, underwritten by the Blue Crown Spark Plug Company, had ordered two front drive cars that were very similar in appearance to the Novi, and those cars were also entered. So it wasn't entirely fair to say that ASPAR had all of the top cars. And so it came that when the closing date arrived and the track opened, there were only 35 entries, and some of those were not the greatest. As the month wore on, there was a lot of negotiation went on, and the bottom line is that Ralph Hepburn and Wilbur Shaw, who were very good friends, Hepburn was a member of ASPAR, Shaw, who was now on the other side of the fence and president and general manager of the track, they worked out a deal whereby post entries would be accepted. But by the time it was settled, it was so late, and then ASPAR turned out to have not nearly the depth of field that they had claimed to have. And so when qualifying entered, they had 28 cars, and some of them were very questionable. The drivers' meeting was held on the afternoon before the race. And as a result of that, it was agreed, or out of that meeting came an agreement to open the track for another 1 hour for additional qualifying, which they did, I think, from 6 until 7 the night before the race. And they had, at one point, four or five different cars on the track at the same time. How they kept a track of it, I have no idea. Two cars met the deadline, and so they had 30 qualifiers.
Any chance that we can, even when we're talking about odd occurrences or sometimes, you know, tragic occurrences, but when you're talking about Donald Davidson and you're listening to Donald Davidson, it makes everybody happy, especially if you are enjoying a meal, like a Happy Meal. Where would you get one of those? Well, it just happens to be one of the places where you might see Donald Davidson. That will all make sense, what I just said, when we come back to Beyond the Bricks.
In the construction business and tired of dealing with the indifference of big corporate suppliers, Quality Supply and Tool on South Harding Street understands. For over 25 years, owner Kevin Anne has had a different approach.
We at Quality Supply and Tool take pride in being a locally owned family business, committed to service. And every customer's needs are different, and we truly believe in shaping our business to our customers' needs. That's what separates us from the competition.
That's Quality Supply and Tool, with additional locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to serve Hoosiers better. Partner with Quality Supply and Tool and think outside the box. Store.
Hey, all. I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there. But you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at kesimpta.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
1947, Donald.
Maury Rose, 116.338.
How's he do it?
How? The official Indy 500 Trivia Cup from McDonald's. Every winner in his average speed are right here. Get your 32-ounce cup filled with Coca-Cola at McDonald's for only 79 cents.
1969, Donald.
Mario Andretti, 156.867.
Maybe your name should be McDonald Davidson.
Why's that?
Davidson, the subject for tonight's episode of Beyond the Bricks, inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. My name is Jake Query, along with Mike Thompson, Landon Coons here as well. And before we get to some more of the audio, as we pay tribute to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway historian emeritus Donald Davidson, in honor of the fact that it was 61 years ago to this date that he first paid visit to 16th and Georgetown, Mike, I simply want to point out, as I know, and I will allow you to expand upon this, the two of us both have had the great fortune of being able to be around Donald. And I don't necessarily mean that from the standpoint of how fortunate we are just to hear his stories and continue off the microphone to hear his contribution of knowledge for the two of us and the tutelage that comes with that. But rather, just because I think people need to know, although they can tell by hearing his voice on radio, what an incredibly dear, kind, and loyal individual Donald Davidson is.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's an incredibly kind person, an amazing mentor, amazing friend. You know, he'll just call up and just ask how I'm doing. And he always knows. It's funny because he always knows the right time to call if I'm down or I'm not feeling right or something. And he's just like, I was thinking of you. And, you know, and he calls always at the right times. And, you know, he's an incredible person. And I'm so blessed and lucky to have him in my life. That's all I can say. It just, without choking up and crying for the rest of the episode, it's just, I'm very, very lucky to have him in my life.
Well, and the thing is, it is strictly by happenstance, Mike, that the two of us have gotten a chance to know Donald on a personal level. And I mention that only because I want to make very, very clear to those that are listening to us. Both Mike and I are well aware of two things. Number one, the great fortune that we've had for that fact. And number two, the fact that it is simply that, a great fortune. And by no means in any way, shape, or form does it make us any more deserving of having Donald in our lives than everybody who is listening. But I want to make sure everybody knows, If you have listened to Donald Davidson, if you participated in Talk of Gasoline Alley, you too are his friend, and it is held so dear to him, and it is so incredibly important to him, and the man that you're hearing on the radio is, in fact, the person that you know off the radio, because he is that authentic and genuine. As for some of the subjects that he's talked about over the course of the years, let's go to Bruce McLaren, who was a huge name in Grand Prix racing, Can-Am racing worldwide, a massive star when he entered cars at the 500, but he never actually drove in the race. Donald Davidson on why that fact is as it is.
Why? I mean, we know why in 1968 Bruce McLaren didn't go to the qualifying line. Was because the cars were illegal and they withdrew them, and we get that. But when he brought his own team, was it just a situation that Bruce McLaren said, I need to focus on being the owner of the cars, or was there another reason he decided I'm not going to drive?
I really don't know. I think he came in 1968 out of curiosity, and when the Shelby cars with Dennis Holm was the teammate, when the cars were withdrawn because of an apparent illegality, Holm was hired by Dan Gurney, or Goodyear, if you like, to drive a Gurney Olsenite Eagle. Bruce McLaren, I don't know if he was offered cars, but I'm sure that he was. But I think he just didn't care for Indianapolis, is my guess. And then in 70, which was the first year for Team McLaren, they had three cars, and the drivers were Dennis Holm and Chris Amon. And then the third car was assigned to A period, N period, other. And I remember that being at USAC, that threw them into a tizzy because they didn't know who that was. And we're going to have to get his driving record. And I said, no. It's a joke. It means an other. That had been used in England for years. If you didn't know who the driver was going to be, you put A and other. And Bruce did get in and drove, but I don't know if he was out for any more than a handful of laps. I don't know if he went out on two or three different days of that, but it was just strictly, he had no intention of driving in the race. He went out strictly to see what does this feel like. They were just strictly test tops when, virtually nobody was around.
In the mid-1960s, an unusual partnership was formed in the garage area, Mike, by two people who on paper seemed like total opposites, Andy Granatelli and Colin Chapman. Now, Mike, Donald expanded a little bit on the fact that, and I just want people to know, back in the day, you can look at it now and say, okay, I understand, but these guys were not necessarily two that you would have thought of in the same breath at the time this partnership came about.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to ask this question to Donald in one of our recording sessions. And these came about, I just wanted people to know, a lot of times, both when I worked at WIBC and then when I didn't work at WIBC, Donald and I would just take Donald to a recording studio and we would just sit there and I would ask questions, kind of like what you and I are doing. We would just sit there and want to talk about a topic, and then I'd ask Donald the question, and then I'd think of a question off of that question, and it would be kind of a free-flowing conversation. And so one of the times we got talking about Bruce McLaren and, Colin Chapman and Andy Granatelli, and I came up and just asked, I said, that just seems like an unusual combination, an unusual partnership, Andy Granatelli and Colin Chapman, two people you wouldn't put together necessarily. How did that come about? And so I had the opportunity to ask him that question.
Talking about the boss of STP and Andy Granatelli, the boss of Lotus and Colin Chapman, Mike and Donald Davidson.
Had actually been, that was an odd sponsorship when Ford Motor Company, which pretty much, I think, underwrote the entire Lotus team in 63, 64, and 65, in 66, they cut way back. And Colin Chapman now was in the position of looking for a sponsor, which is something they didn't do in Europe, but they shortly would. But at that time, they weren't doing that. But Chapman had seen how that worked and how Granatelli and Chapman ever got together, I can't imagine. But when they made the deal, you know, you thought, what's wrong with this picture? Here's British gentleman, David Niven lookalike, Colin Chapman, the gentleman farmer from Scotland, mild-mannered Jim Clark, and Andy, who's not, if you were to use a description, mild-mannered wouldn't be one of the terms that you would use. But they ran as a team in 66 and 67. And then when the team of wedges was a team of four, actually, was prepared for 1968, Jim Clark was to be the lead driver and, in fact, was here either the week or 2 weeks before the fatal accident. I've never gone back to figure out when that was. But he was fatally injured at Hockenheim in Germany. But he had just left here from, testing one of those cars because he was to be the lead driver. And then the trials and tribulations that came thereafter was would take a whole show. But, as I say, in retrospect, Andy was one of the more important people in the history of the 500.
He also, Mike, I think it's safe to say, Andy Granatelli, not only one of the more important personalities at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, but also just one of the most charismatic and somebody that was the ultimate showman, that was really kind of one of those that helped make the event what it was in that era.
Oh, there's no question. Andy Granatelli was good for racing. I mean, he was a showman, as you said, but he was very good at promotion. He was very good at bringing attention to the event. He was good at bringing attention to himself. There's no doubt about it. He was a great self-promoter, but he was also good at bringing attention to racing as a whole, and racing was better for Andy Granatelli's involvement. There's no doubt about
it. Of course, Andy Granatelli is so important with STP and putting together the outfits with the STP logo on them. Just part of the always ongoing story between sponsors and automobile manufacturing companies that were involved with racing. And, of course, the tire companies were a huge, huge part of that in bringing in those Grand Prix stars like we talked about from the 1960s. So a bit of a follow-up on that. Donald Davidson on tire companies bringing Grand Prix drivers to the world's most famous oval.
Firestone and Goodyear were going at it, and I don't even know if they had a budget. They were just trying to get everybody, and the thinking was that the Formula One drivers were best to adapt to the rear engine cars. And so over they came, which was great for the public. But the sad thing was that a lot of those drivers were on contract and didn't care to be here. Some of them got to like it. I think Dennis Holm, I think it took about 3 years. He said, I'm beginning to like the place. And, Clark apparently was not a fan of being here, but he was under contract. And so I don't know if any one of the Grand Prix drivers truly wanted to be here. I mean, Dan Gurney had already done it. I mean, that was, but I don't know if that was his boyhood ambition. And most notably, Jochen Rindt clearly didn't want to be here. And I remember thinking how unfair that was, because I was working for USAC, and I was for the coming up through the ranks point of view, and I thought how sad it was that the drivers that were running USAC all the time, trying to get to the Speedway, and then maybe were even there. All of the good rides were given to drivers that really didn't care to be. But you had Graham Hill, and when you look at that 67 lineup, it's not like that those were Formula One drivers that were, they didn't have a ride, and so they were looking to run at the Speedway. They were all at the top of their game. And going back and forth, I'd have to count up and see, but golly, there was probably 12 Formula One guys here, because you had Graham Hill and Jackie Stewart, Jim Clark, Jochen Rindt, Lucien Bianchi, as you mentioned, and Pedro Rodriguez, who didn't make it, and then Chris Amon had been here, and others that I'm not... Oh, Richie Ginther. and Dan, who was an American but in Formula One. Mashton Gregory was had driven and drove in 65, but he was in 67 trying to make it. And so, I mean, it was probably up a dozen people that were running Formula One now that were here. But that changed dramatically in 68. And I think really that it was the tire companies that were heavily responsible for that.
It's funny, Mike, when he mentions there, Jochen Rindt clearly didn't want to be there. We've played that audio in past versions of Beyond the Bricks. And yes, I think that's a safe assumption.
I think that's pretty much a given. I mean, and Jochen would speak his mind, and that's one of the reasons why he's one of my all-time favorite drivers. He would speak his mind and say what was on his mind at all times.
He would just say it with great brevity, right? That much we know, right?
No. not much.
That's pretty much how he answered questions. Tomorrow at the Speedway, by the way, gates are going to open at 10 o'clock in the morning. And then it is Fast Friday. Put some extra boost in those cars. Let's see what we can get in terms of letting those babies run from noon until 6. Practice for the greatest spectacle in racing. And then, of course, with qualifying getting underway this weekend, the qualifying draw will take place at 6:15. That will run until 7 o'clock tomorrow in preparation for the 109th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race. Of course, we'll talk to you tomorrow night with another episode of Beyond the Bricks.
Seeing the horizon from the driver's seat? Beautiful. Seeing it from a fold-up chair in Daytona Beach? Life-changing. Plan your summer road trip today at DaytonaBeach.com/road trip. Beach on.